Hello, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
Welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each episode, we open to a random article in the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we invite the author to discuss their topic. So it's all about the craft of game writing. Today, we have Josh Scher. Welcome, welcome.
Hello, hello.
Could you please introduce yourself to our listeners and share a little bit about your background?
Sure. My name is Josh Scher. I am currently a game narrative and game narrative design consultant for my little company of one, Cautionary Tales. Prior to this, I was with the developer Naughty Dog for close to 22 years. I started there actually as an animator in the cinematics department, and gradually wheedled my way into the narrative department, where I was the co-writer on Uncharted 4 and Uncharted: The Lost Legacy and The Last of Us Part 2 as well. And since Naughty Dog, I joined a startup called Crop Circle, where I was the narrative director. That unfortunately went the way of many startups. And since then, I have been doing the game narrative consulting thing.
Perfect. Thank you, Josh. What we'd like to do is just start with the article that you've written for GNK, just to hear a little bit about the angle that you took, what your thesis was, and how you might summarize it for our listeners.
Sure. So I read an article called Call Me By My Name, which... Part of the work that I did while I was Naughty Dog was helping develop the systemic enemy dialogue for The Last of Us Part 2. And the article delves into one very specific aspect of the enemy dialogue, which is the fact that they actually call out their names in the midst of combat. And this was a particularly interesting problem for me to solve, because so often in games, particularly like military-style shooters or whatnot, is that the enemies all tend to be, you know, faceless, anonymous, and just sort of a blank slate onto which you can project whatever you feel like projecting in these combat games onto them. And part of the idea with The Last of Us Part 2 was that, of course, you know, obviously the whole revenge is bad thing, but also just the idea that, you know, it's sort of like hollows out your soul and sort of like strips you of your humanity. And so I sort of wanted to find a way to remind the players that, you know, you are in fact actually killing other people with lives and families and hopes and dreams and all that sort of thing, you know, which, you know, to use the phrase that I use in my article is, you know, granted a little bit fucked up, but it is something that sort of, I think, lent itself to the tone of the game. And so in the article, I just sort of talk about the challenge of, like, you know, well, how do you get the enemies to call each other by their names? And as it turns out, as with, I think, many things in video games, it ended up being considerably more complicated than we thought. So I sort of get into the very bare bones basics of it in the article.
Amazing. Well, I mean, I really enjoyed the contribution to the book, because obviously it's quite a range of topics that we get in the book. But it's nice to have one that goes into the real sort of specific technical detail. Like, obviously the actual game probably jumps through 100 other hurdles that your article doesn't cover, but by the nature of game development. But it's nice to see something that's really sort of crafted from the ground up so that people can read it and really see how you went about it. I guess my first question is, the system you outline uses a lot of kind of procedural assembly to get those names in and to try and bring the individual characters a little bit more to kind of to individuate them, I guess, these enemies. Yeah. How far can you push a system like this? Like, what do you reckon the upper limit of this actually is in practice?
Oh, boy. I mean, the limit, as with so many other things in games, is often just defined by, like, your deadlines and your budget and everything else like that. But
let me rephrase the question. What's the limit in theory, then, not in practice?
the thing that I think was most interesting to me about this system is that it really was kind of like thinking about, you know, okay, how do people how do people actually speak? How do individual just like sentences get broken down into things that are like tiny little chunks that can be potentially recorded separately? And then how does one, stitch these all together in a way that sounds like a natural flow of something coming out of a person's mouth and not like three separate individual recorded messages, sort of like the example I used in the article. You don't want it to sound like, "Hello, Todd, your prescription is ready," right? It's just sounds, it sounds weird. It sounds weird and unnatural. And so just in terms of like full conversations, it's really just kind of like thinking about what you would in any kind of narrative game, or just like, what are the, or any dialogue scene, what are the people like trying to say to each other? What are they hiding from each other? What are they, what are they trying to accomplish through the dialogue? And then thinking about possibly, previous scenes, what choices have you made previously that might want to come up here? And so it really, as you're very familiar with your own games, it just becomes like, how do I break down the essence of, how do I break down this conversation to individual like little dialogue pieces that can then be reassembled and put back together. The sky's the limit, but as I also sort of like touch on in the article, the question then also becomes like, how much is what's the bang for the buck? Like, how much is the player actually going to notice all this trickery that you're doing behind the scene? And how complicated do you want to make it for yourself, if the overall effect is not something that is really going to be felt by the player? That's kind of like what it comes down to.
You said something pretty interesting, Josh, where you were saying, how does the player feel? You sort of introduced this concept of time, both in the article and just now in your answer. Like, how does a player feel at a certain time? How do they feel a little bit later? And you had this quote in the article that stuck with me, which is a very clever narrative design might not include names at first, just to let the player fall into a mode of being more aggressive with these sort of faceless NPCs and then start to introduce them over time. And it does occur to me that it requires a game structure that has a certain amount of awareness or knowledge about where the player is going to be at any point, i.e. a Naughty Dog style, slightly more linear adventure, right? If you were doing a roguelite or you're doing like a game with an open world where you might see the same batches of enemies in different ways, could this system work there to some degree? Have you ever seen anything like
I
that?
think I believe it can, because ultimately, whether it's a roguelike where you're like, say, trying to get through a gauntlet and make it a little bit further each time, or whether it is like a fairly open world thing, I think it can still work, because ultimately what you're doing is you're sort of taking a look at, whether those names start to get introduced as and compare it to the amount of playtime. So, obviously with Naughty Dog, we know there's going to be X number of combat encounters throughout the game. So it's sort of like, okay, after a combat encounter 10, this is when you start hearing Todd's and Steve's and Karen's or whatever. Versus, an open world game, you ultimately just sort of come down to the same sort of thing. And we did something kind of harking back to a previous question in terms of like, bits and pieces of dialogue together in Uncharted: Lost Legacy. In the pseudo open world section in that game, where, in classic video game section fashion, you have to go to like three temples and do three things in order to progress to the next section. But you can do those three temples in any order, and the trick there was that the two characters, Chloe and Nadine, this was kind of like a getting to know you style section, and so. And so what I did there is for particular dialogue moments throughout that level, we would essentially have a check to see like, how many temples have you solved, right? So if you haven't solved any temples and like you get through a combat section, Nadine might say something like, okay, let's keep moving, something very terse and non-personal, whatever, they haven't really developed things. But then if you've done two temples, then after that same particular combat section, she might say like, "Hey, nice job," or something like that. Not anything quite so trite, but the idea though is that you can sort of like make this sort of a reactive dialogue based on how far you are into the scenario that you set up. So, yeah.
I love that that kind of means that we're tying the way the world speaks to the players, kind of to the player's progression. It's almost like as the you're basically tying it to the number of kills in Uncharted. That's effectively,
More or
well,
less,
sorry, not in
yes.
Uncharted, in The Last of Us. That's effectively what you're doing. So the more people you kill, the more you notice that they're real people. Like to start with, oh, they're just drones. But like by the fifth one, you're starting to think, hang on a minute. I think that's kind of,
there's
yeah, there's a
yeah, we always we kind of joked grimly when we were making Uncharted 2, just with the sheer number of people that Nathan Drake takes out over the course of the adventure, that it's sort of like you find some documents on somebody, like like a family photo or like things like that. You're like, oh my God. But Uncharted was obviously not the right game for that, whereas The Last of Us
It's a different genre. Yeah, exactly.
absolutely is the right game for that kind of introspection.
So I think that leads on to a really fascinating question. This sound, or I think this is a fascinating question, though. It sounds like a dig, but I absolutely don't mean it as one. So you remember the bit in Austin Powers, right, where everybody remembers this, where the henchman dies, and then it cuts to the guys in the bar, and they're about to celebrate the birthday, and they get the phone call, and it's like, oh my God, he's been crushed by a steamroller. Obviously, a very funny moment and a critique of Bond films. But how do you? Because my worry would be if I was implementing something like that Last of Us system that you were talking about, my worry would be that it would become accidentally comedic by some sort of backdoor process. Like maybe it's because, I don't know, the system starts calling everybody by their name. So it's all Steve, Jeff, Sandra, Bob. Do you know what I
Well,
mean?
oh
You
yeah,
must
no,
have
I
hit
mean,
this. So.
I touch on it in the article a little bit, where it does sort of like stops being disturbing and starts being hilarious, right? And a lot of this comes down to just the skill of the narrative designers and the dialogue designers. The system was so Naughty Dog has its own internal scripting language, which handles a lot of game events and things like that, including when dialogue fires. And
Oh, okay.
the scripting, the scripting language is fairly robust. It weirdly resembles Lisp. Like there's just so many parentheses everywhere. It's crazy. But the head dialogue designer on this, Mike Hourihan, we just had a lot of conversations about these kinds of things. And at a certain point, there is a practical consideration, which is that we simply did not have enough names that they could be constantly saying them throughout every single combat encounter, because then you absolutely would get repetition, and you would sort of wonder just how many people in this faction are named Steve, right?
And you would inevitably get one faction where there were seven people called Steve.
Civilization has fallen, and we've also run out of names. It's just terrible. So a lot of it just comes down to one, like making sure that it only happens possibly once per encounter, and maybe even then not every time. Like you're just able to set any number of flags, sort of things, like make sure this fight. And it worked the same way with like pretty much every single bark, because obviously in The Last of Us, there are any number of times the enemies can say the equivalent of like, "There she is, killer!" Right? So I had like, I don't even know how many variations of that, but obviously you want to make sure that like the same one does not fire and very often, so you have this, you use the same kind of checks that you would for that. There were a couple of things we explored, one of which was like sort of like having like a stack of names, and it was sort of like go through, but that ultimately proved to be needlessly complicated. And so what ended up happening was Mike just essentially went through the different combat counters in the game and assigned a name to each person in that encounter. And in some cases, because again, we were limited on the number of names. Like I think I seem to recall we recorded like 20 names per faction. Steve would pop up on a semi-regular basis, but what would happen is if you shot Steve in encounter A and then shot Steve again in encounter B, like half an hour later, Mike would make sure that nobody would call out Steve's name.
Right. Ever again. Yeah.
So,
When you mentioned this in the article, I love this, right? Because it's you can see the voice of the experienced games writer behind here, where you're like, there is the proper way of doing this. There's also the easy way, and it works better, right? Like, just do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a game of this scope and complexity, the fact that we were able to do it this way was just fine, was fine, because it made it a little bit more dynamic and made everybody's play experience a little bit different. And it wasn't like, you watch somebody playing this game on YouTube, and every single time you get to encounter five, like, you hear Steve's name combo out, right? But if you're working on a smaller budget, have a smaller team, and are trying to get like one very specific moment across, yeah, there's no reason you can't just script this moment in the middle of your game to play off, and
I mean,
achieve a similar effect. Yeah.
to me, it plays to that standard conversation people have around procedural generation for narrative, that you think, oh, I've got this enormous amount of space to fill. In fact, I don't necessarily know how long the space is going to even be for players. So I'll build this system that will be able to just fill it with story content, fill it with meaningful moments and meaningful character, and then you build the system, and it takes an incredibly long time to build, and then you spend the next 6 months turning it all off again because it's firing everywhere, and suddenly everybody has a colorful and interesting backstory and really just there to sell you a lemon or whatever. And that kind of endless ebb and flow. So I guess, if I want to turn that into a question, it's having been through the development of several big linear adventures, having been through procedural systems, having been through all the things you've been through. Procedural generation, is it worth it, or should we just not be doing it?
I think it really depends on the kind of game. I mean, this is like the broad, easy answer, but it's really depends on the kind of game that you're trying to make. Like, and I think, well, I'll sort of use this as an anecdote. Like, in that same level in Lost Legacy, where you can go in any order, and the dialogue will change based on what order you do the things in, and like where you go and things like that. And I remember at some point saying to the team when we were working on this, which was something to the effect of, if we do this well, nobody will notice the fact that we're
The
basically
classic.
pulling off this trick, right? And so the question then becomes, for procedural generation and things like that, the question is like, why are you doing it? Which is like, I mean, and doing it because it's fun and an interesting challenge is a totally legit reason to do it, I think. But I think it's also just sort of a question of like, what do you want the effect to be on the player, right? And the question then becomes like, the same sort of like bang for the buck question, like, can you achieve a similar effect? Because part of the reason one of the reasons you do proc gen stuff is because you want everybody who's playing the game to have a slightly different experience, or you want people to, like, say, be able to play your game and not necessarily have the exact same thing happen to them the second time through. Which, you play a Naughty Dog game, it's pretty much going to be exactly the same thing every time you go through. But if you want to play, something else, the way that I run through Overboard or Expelled, for example, there are certain events that play out a certain way and things like that, but I'm going to do it probably in a different order than anybody else and have my a unique experience that way.
I'm glad you brought back up Lost Legacy, actually, because when you were talking about Nadine's responses and sort of what she would say, it occurs to me that this question of barks is incredibly important because, of course, probably most of what you do in a typical game like this is interact with kind of nameless NPCs that you're giving names to. But the things that people often remember the most are the named piece or the named NPCs, right? Your key interactions, your sort of key encounters. And you're really at Naughty Dog, you're really well known for this mix of this gentle, really characterful commentary that would happen on key action triggers. So, like, two people are walking through a space, they would comment on say the environment. You'd learn something about them in the process. Did you always find it easier to separate out the sort of, say, like the combat-y, bark-filled encounter spaces with these more characterful moments? Or would you ever have times where you would sort of intermingle something from your key companion, your main sort of partner, that's an important piece of dialogue or reveal something very important with, these aren't throwaway pieces, of course, but with the sort of gauntlet of enemies you might be coming through and what they might say?
The trick with the combat encounters is that, and with the combat barks is that, obviously you need to communicate stuff really fast in a high intensity moment, right? So usually if your partner is saying something, what they're saying is like behind you or something like that, some things like that, which is not to say that you can't like throw something in the middle of of the combat, but oftentimes, how to put this, there's sort of like this hierarchy of how much you have the player's attention, right? And these kind of things, like, if you're watching a cutscene, you have their full attention, or possibly they're off making coffee somewhere because they don't watch cutscenes, but right, but cutscenes, it's just you and them, and then you have the exploratory bits. And it's there that you can have like these sort of little moments back and forth as you're doing, as you're, climbing around the environment, like looking for stuff, and or in The Last of Us, you're like scavenging for supplies to craft and things like that. And then the more you, and then it like in the driving sections of Lost Legacy, I was sort of aware that it was convenient in the sense that, you could have the players in the Jeep and they're driving around, but ultimately, they are also still trying to figure out where the hell they're supposed to be going, and occasionally, like pulling out the map and things like that. So you might not have their full, undivided attention with what's going on. And then ultimately, when they're in combat, they're going to be like, ah! So if you're going to have these, if you're going to have these moments, and you have to, you sort of have to really plan for them above and beyond that. And then also, there's also the problem of like, are they in stealth? Okay, if they're in stealth and you're kind of like, and you're kind of like sneaking through and like taking care of people quietly, you just sort of have to be okay with that moment maybe never triggering, because obviously you don't want to, you don't want
It'd be
them to be sort
weird
of
if they
like,
interrupted you while you're sneaking up on
and
something.
also, yeah, and also depending on what they're saying, it might be a little bit dissonant to be like, it was like, did I ever tell you why I hate my father so much? Right,
Sneaking up behind the guy going, "Hey, did I tell you what happened to Brenda last week? It was crazy."
Well, it's like you have to take your key story content, right, and like parcel out which vehicle is best for it, right?
I think that's really interesting, though. I mean, I don't disagree with anything you're saying at all. It's very well put. But I was thinking about like the Marvel movie, right? The Marvel movie model. I quite often think about that when I'm thinking about action adventure games because they feel like they really want to be the same thing and in the same space. But a lot of the recent Marvel movies, the sheer joy of them comes to the fact that when they're having a big fight scene, they're also doing character dialogue. Like we're watching them punch people, but really we're listening to Iron Man and Captain America duking it out or whatever, or Spider-Man saying something funny. And the attention problem in a film seems to go almost the other way. It's like when we're in a fight scene, our audience can kind of relax because it's just swooshing lights and colorful noises, and they don't need to really follow what's going on. So that's a great moment for them to enjoy character drama. But when we translate it into games, it's, yeah, no, that's a real problem, actually. If we're having a fight, the player is totally 100% focused, and anything you tell them that isn't move now is going to go out the window. I've never heard that so clearly. Had that so clearly outlined for me before, but I think that's really
Yeah,
true.
and I mean, I think, and I mean, and the thing is too, like, in a Marvel movie and things like that, the fight in some ways, like, is the dialogue. That is, the character continue to express themselves in their way, whether it's like I am the highly techno Iron Man thing, or I am the Norse doofus with the hammer, or like whatever happens to be, they are expressing the character, their character, like through the way that they fight. And that's true to, that's true to a large extent as well, in games, or it's certainly in the types of games that, Naughty Dog tried to make. Whereas, like we were always very clear with Nathan Drake from the get-go, when Amy Hennig was developing the character, that he is, not a trained soldier. He is not, and that he is much more along the lines of Indiana Jones. He's an ordinary guy. So, like, when he's hiding in cover, he's not going to look like super tactical and things like that. He's going to be a dude hiding in cover, like shit, shit, shit. And when he's fighting, he's not going to be like, doing Krav Maga on somebody or like whatever. He's going to be like doing these big wine roundhouse punches, or he's going to be using way too much effort and energy and like all that kind of stuff. It's sort of like the personality comes through them versus, like Joel in The Last of Us, which is like, here's a guy in his 50s, and he's not going to be moving very fast. And in this particular world where like one false move could mean that you're dead, he's going to be brutal and efficient in the way that he takes people down. So, in the first game, Ellie, of course, is going to say like, "Jesus Christ, Joel!" Right? So, you get those little bits and moments in the combat there, so you can sort of see like, here's Joel, like I'm shoving this guy's face into a desk, and Ellie's going to respond accordingly. And then same likewise in the sequel, like, watching Ellie early on with Dina and sort of like seeing the tenderness there, but then at a certain point, Dina goes away, Ellie is on her own, and Ellie's dialogue, for what little of it there is to herself, becomes a lot more determined and focused and grim. And occasionally reminding the player, being like, "I'm supposed to be going over there," because sometimes people get
So
lost.
I think, so I mean, that sounds to me like one thing that you were able to do at Naughty Dog, which is really quite extraordinary, maybe, is use the physicality of the character to tell the story of the character. Because I mean, the rather than just relying on the dialogue the whole time, like as an indie, we will only ever have one animation for anything, right, that
Right.
we do. So if we even have an animation, so yeah, we tend to lean on dialogue to solve all of our problems, which is not always the best, most efficient
Yeah,
solution.
no, and I mean, I think one thing that we always tried to balance at Naughty Dog, and sometimes I think we succeeded and sometimes not, is to not have the characters talking all the damn time, because really you want it to be sometime you want particularly in the Last of Us games, you want these quiet moments. And one thing that was really interesting to me was that during the development of the first game, which, by the way, I was not really involved with the first game. I was doing early development work on Uncharted 4 when they were making that. So it was kind of interesting to see this from the outside. When the game was not done yet, and you had Joel like, wandering through these, gray box environments, and like trying to help them flesh out the gameplay and things like that, a lot of people were concerned that the game was like too quiet and too boring, because
I love this point. I love this
you know
point.
there there's there's
Yeah.
no, there's no dialogue. It's sort of like, what are they doing? And it was only after like the graphics were done, the in particular the ambient sound design was in and all that kind of stuff, and you sort of really appreciated the, quiet stillness of these abandoned places. And then you're just sort of like, oh. But so much of that had to sort of be taken on faith, just because, again, you have video games, particularly action adventure games, particularly the Uncharted games that came before, it was just so full of chatter that it was really just like, there just had to be a great deal of faith and confidence placed in the idea. It's just like, hey, maybe what if we didn't do that for this game?
A real difference in sort of narrative direction. I so love that you've said this, because we talk about this actually at the Chinese Room a lot, in our narrative team. It's almost a given that this feeling will happen in the development of almost any sort of relatively 3D, double A, triple A type of title, because it is always faster to put words into a text editor than it is to produce an environment, right? So, or to produce great SFX, or to produce like great tech art, or what have you. So you'll almost always have everyone demanding the narrative team to put some scratch in quick or some whatever, so that they can test it out. And like we've almost come to the conclusion at TCR that like you cannot. We should stop seeing that as a concern, where we try to sort of explain to people like it's okay, it will make more sense because of you, because of all of your departments and all of the great work you are doing. It's almost better to put in more when the game has less, and then strip it back out and sort of budget for that fact. Budget almost like that's just like work in progress placeholder, and then to strip back out some of this dialogue. But it just seems a pattern that repeats constantly, because it's like a game in development, especially a new IP, is just it's like sand between your fingers, right? It's just slipping through. And for people to have the same image in their mind of the tone of the mood is so difficult. And writing can do a lot to help with that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think that helped was particularly again with The Last of Us was Neil and Bruce, excuse me, Neil and Bruce made a point of trying to get the team on board with the things that influenced The Last of Us. So they've sort of like everybody was like, please go watch Children of Men, please go watch No Country for Old Men, please watch another film that ends with the word men, right? It's sort of like
Steinbeck of mice and men.
I just realized that anyway. But just the idea of you have in No Country for Old Men that extended face off between I can't remember the characters' names, but Josh Brolin and Anton Chigurh, where it's just like very quiet except for the sudden punctuated bursts of gunfire and intensity, and then it gets really quiet again. And that was really the kind of the feeling that they wanted to get. And then likewise, Children of Men, those moments where everything wasn't blowing up and Clive Owen is just sort of like looking around these spaces. It's sort of like, this is the vibe that this is the vibe that we want to convey in this game. And again, a lot of it just sort of comes down to taking things on faith. And it's tricky with these kinds of games because, as you say, sometimes you want to put dialogue in to sort of patch up issues with possibly your level design or environment design, things like that. Like you realize that people are constantly getting lost in this one space, and you are unable to, for whatever reason, make any changes. And so you are compelled to like have the character say something like, "Hey, what do we like? What? Why don't we try like heading up to that hill over there? No, not that hill. The other one. The one with
The
the one that
yellow
has
one.
fewer trees on it. The one that has fewer trees on it." And it's very, very tempting. There have been a few games in the not too distant past that I will not name that where the main character just never stopped talking. And it actually put me off the game because like I felt like I was not being allowed to have a moment to take in what I was looking at and explore. And I sometimes have to wonder like how much of that was like the result of just the developers being concerned, or how much of it might have been external play testers just sort of being like, I'm lost and I'm confused. And that's always a particularly tricky balance to maintain. Because, part of the thing of, when we made games at Naughty Dog is that, we were telling a story and we really, really, really wanted people to see the story through to the end. And we did that through a number of like ways, like through the difficulty settings, and also like some frankly incredible accessibility features. Like it's actually possible to play through The Last of Us 2 as a blind person, which still kind of boggles my mind. They did an amazing job with that. But even still, people will get stuck. And the thing that was always interesting to me also about like say the puzzles in Uncharted is they always started much more complicated than they ended up. Because ultimately we wanted people to sort of like feel clever, but we also didn't want to like stop them dead. It wasn't like we're not like making blueprints here. We're making a thing, and sort of like, oh, we lined the lights up, oh, thing opens, like, cool, I'm so clever, now keep going. So that was always a balance to maintain.
I would love to find some strategies for dealing with this kind of things. We recently released a game at Inkle called TR49, which has quite a lot of
Yes.
that kind of ambient, oh, we should do this now, or maybe I can do that next. And we generally found that like a lot of the vocal people who got back to us were like, oh, this game talks way too much. It's constantly telling me what to do, and I'm in this vibe of attention. And at the time, I was a bit like, okay, right, because to me that game is an exploration game. You're exploring your way through an
Yes.
archive. It's that low attention looking at the scenery mode that you talked about earlier. But to people playing it, I think actually what they were doing was a high concentration activity. If I'm reading and I'm solving the puzzles and these guys are voices in my ears, and I was like, oh right, actually this is the same content, it's the same material being appreciated in two completely different ways by completely different people. And I don't even know if we can solve this anymore, because every time we added a line to nag someone, it was because I watched a playtest. I saw them fail to do the thing. Like, there was no choice for us about the lines. And I imagine that's the same with Uncharted, with The Last of Us, with all of these games, that, like, the reason the person talks so much is because someone's got a video of someone going, I hate this game, I'm totally sad. Like, what do we do? Like, can we...
Right, you know, it's the self moment, right? It's sort of like, not that there's shelves anymore because everything's sold digitally, but, you know, it's the same idea. Or I should say it's the buried in the Steam library moment, right? You know, it's taken out of favorites. And it's a tricky problem. So in the Naughty Dog games, generally what we would do is we would have hinty lines on timers of some sort. And there are other factors too. Like the designers could actually sort of be like, how many times has the player gone back and forth between these two points done the thing that they're supposed to do, right? but there is also the idea of the timer, in Lost Legacy there is one puzzle in particular that's sort of like a sliding tile puzzle with that projects shadows, and that was probably the hardest one in the game. And in that particular one, we actually did. I forgot about. There are these other sort of like maze-like puzzles with statues in that game too, and I actually recorded lines of Nadine saying things like, "Maybe try moving this one next," or like it could actually like sort of, or in the maze puzzle, like if you just failed it too many times. It would sort of be like, maybe you should try going right and left and right. Like we actually did sort of spell it out. And at a certain point on both puzzles, there is basically a just solve the fucking puzzle already button that you could press that would come up after about, I don't know, like 10 or 15 minutes or something like that. If you were just completely stuck. And I think we actually had Nadine say like, want me to do it? and the screen would like fade to black and then fade back out again. I'm not sure how I'd be curious, like we tracked everything. I would be curious to know how many times that actually got triggered. But
how many people did it? You know,
yeah, but most of the time I'm watching streamers. Yeah, it seems like they figured it out. So
yeah.
Most of the ones you've seen have figured it out, you're saying.
Yeah.
So
I think
this is very interesting because I feel like the genre matters a lot in this topic here of like sort of puzzles obstacles you put where you want someone to get through, but you also, if they don't do it, they're going to feel like the game was weightless a little bit maybe, or that they feel like they sort of just like washed past a bunch of obstacles. John and I go to this conference called AdventureX, which is focused on adventure games. And what's interesting is that's a game genre that has really interested in how they present puzzles and then present hints or solutions to players, right? And it does strike me that like there is a certain momentum you really need to have, or that you expect to have in an action adventure game, that expectation is not necessarily there, you know, in like especially a more traditional point and click adventure game. You're expected to sort of sit there. And so just like you were talking about accessibility and all the innovations we've done there, it's amazing what innovations have happened in the adventure game space of when you want to summon a hint, how you can do that in such a way where the player isn't made to feel not smart enough, I suppose, to sort of solve the puzzle. Yep. And it strikes me, based on what you're saying, like I wonder which or if any of these can sort of merge together, because you want to be able to put cool puzzles that feel exciting, right?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I actually just played. If you're familiar with the point and click adventures, the Perfect Tides games. So
the new one,
like, I played. I played the original Perfect Tides, and you know I went through the whole thing, but I sort of had to force myself to, because weirdly, in that particular case, it was a game that was telling a very particular story. And, you know, granted, there are choice moments and things like that that would affect what dialogue options might come up later and that sort of thing. But there are also some slight, but weirdly, the adventure game interface in that game kind of got in its own way a little bit. Mm. Like there are certain bits of friction, and they weren't like really puzzles per se, like you would expect from like a more classic thing on the forum, but there were still things that sort of like stopped things dead for a while. I was sort of trying to figure out like, you know, what is the next thing I'm supposed to do? It's not particularly object. And what I thought was interesting is that for the sequel, the developer Meredith Gran did away with pretty much all of that stuff. Like the sequel is a lot more frictionless, and instead, a lot of the decisions that you make, like, and a lot of things that affect your dialogue choices are things such as, like, you're going to college and you are offered an opportunity to read a lot of different books, and depending on like what you read and what conversations you have, like certain attributes go up and allow you to have different conversations. And honestly, Perfect Tides Station to Station, the sequel, was one of the best of its form that I've played in quite
Really?
some time. Like, yeah, the writing is phenomenal and really kind of yeah, no, I was really impressed with it. And more recently, I just started playing The Drifter, which is
Yeah,
much
great.
more yeah, which is much more traditional in the sense of puzzles and all that sort of thing. But what The Drifter does, which is at least so far, I'm not quite done with it yet, is that it keeps the puzzle spaces relatively small and tends to like strip you of the stuff that you have when you go on to the next thing. So,
So
the
you
piece
don't
of
get this
gum,
explosion of possibility, right? That you can
exactly.
say
Yeah, you
like
don't.
it's clearly
Yeah, the piece.
solvable with these things,
Yeah,
right?
the piece of gum that you found in the first hour is not something that you're gonna have to worry about 14 hours
That's
from now.
silly.
Like,
It's that thank God
it.
I've brought this postage stamp with me, because otherwise I would be in this prison cell forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it is certainly interesting, like, because I grew up playing the old Infocom text adventure games, and those were brutally unforgiving in terms of like, in the first Enchanter game, like there are those one use spell scrolls, and like you could use it on something and ostensibly get something that seems you what you want, and then find out a few hours later is like, oh wait, I actually needed that for this. Did I save my game? No. Oh, I guess I'm starting over. Right. So, there's, but that was just, like super early days. And now there is this, I think with a lot of recent ones I've played, this, desire to, have your player finish the game. So the question is like, what do you do to,
To get the it's a harder problem, right? Like, it's almost
Yeah.
easier to make things difficult that we've learned as an industry, right? Than it is to
Oh,
sort,
yeah.
especially if you're going for an audience, like a bigger audience, right? How do you balance that just right? Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to stick up for Infocom here, because that's also what I grew up playing. My take on it is that Infocom games are in fact roguelikes. And the
Well,
idea
you're supposed to do
is
it. You're supposed to do it. So.
you're supposed
Oh,
to
don't
run,
get.
fail, and then rerun it. And we can prove this, because the core fact of a roguelike is that on your second, third, fourth, fifth run, you're supposed to get faster at running through the
That's true.
content you do. And in an Infocom game, you get faster at typing the commands that work, and you don't type the commands that don't work anymore. And so when you do rerun Enchanter, you can actually get back to where you were really quickly by just going.
That is very true. And I'm certainly not knocking Infocom games. And in fact, I pretty much learned how to touch type because of Infocom games. Like,
Right. But.
at a certain point, when those things were short, I was in seventh grade when I played my first one, and at a certain point I get very fast at take the rock and throw it at the troll, right?
Exactly.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, when you apply the Infocom design to a graphic adventure where you have to sit through the animations, which are of a fixed duration, then that design becomes unacceptable. At that point, you
Yes.
have to do the LucasArts thing of making, no, we're always going to make sure that you can get through this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that was, I'm definitely much more of a LucasArts and Sierra person, largely for that reason. I mean, obviously Sierra pioneered the graphic adventure form in that particular state, but like
But they were
those were
brutal.
also games where you could irrevocably fuck up and not realize it. For
Absolutely.
my favorite example of that being in King's Quest 2, I think there's like a magic door that you have to go through, and that door is across this bridge, and this is a rickety bridge, and the thing is you can cross that bridge just enough times. Like, there's three doors, so it lets you cross it once, see the door, and go back, and then you can do it three more times for each of the keys. And if you cross it one more time than that, it collapses for reasons I don't completely understand. So like, if you just happen to like go across the bridge to go to the door, which is what I did, without needing to, and then go back, what happens is as you're walking with the last key to the third door, as the bridge collapses and you die, and
You
you have to
see, I love
start
that. I love that, because I think one thing that we
over.
do in games is we say to people, "Oh, you're totally safe. Don't worry. It doesn't. You're not really committing to actions." But you know what? You walked across the wobbly bridge for no reason. That was committing to a serious action.
It's been foreshadowed
That's
very
fair.
evidently, right?
That's
I mean,
fair.
what
That's
do you
fair.
expect?
That's fair. I can't argue with that. Oh my God, blame the victim. My God.
Well, since we have been talking about sort of these other models of games, I'm curious a little bit, Josh, because you had such tenure at a studio that was so focused on a specific style of game. At this stage in your career where you are now, are there things you're drawn to that are like the types of games you were making before? Or are you drawn more to slightly different genres? Like, what are the types of problems you're interested in
Oh,
now?
oh man. I have always loved smaller indie style titles. That's just always been the case because I've found that there's, the thing with like a big budget title like the kind that Naughty Dog made is that you have to make it appeal to a very broad audience, and you can't. I shouldn't say you can't take quite as many risks because, I mean, The Last of Us, in many ways, was a very risky proposition, particularly the sequel where we killed the character that everybody loved from the first game. There were certain types of risks that could be taken, but you can't do these wild experiments with form that you can, like, say, in Kentucky Route Zero, which I adore. You can't run the risk of people not, fully engaging or even completing your game. One of my favorite games of all times is Outer Wilds, and and Outer Wilds tells its narrative in a completely nonlinear fashion because once you get out of the little tutorial section, you can approach that game in any order. And granted, there are gates of sorts, like you can't get to this point until you've learned this knowledge, which you get from this point over here. But there's still a lot of stuff that you can do out of order, and so the lore and the backstory that you find, you're just gonna have to like piece together yourself. And that game is driven largely by curiosity rather than like the usual impetus that you find in these kinds of games. And a lot of people bounce
I
off it.
think on the conversation we had earlier about hints for puzzles, Outer Wilds is an incredible example because when you're stuck on a puzzle, you should go and solve something else completely, which by magic will give you a clue to the puzzle you were stuck on. And like that mostly works for 99% of the runtime, which is extraordinary.
No, it's an amazing. I mean, that game is like magic to me in a lot of ways. But in terms of the types of games I like to play, I like to sample from everything, just because game narrative is just so. I mean, sorry, this sounds trite. This it's just so interesting to me because it is so multivariate. It can be approached from so many different ways and means and directions. And I mean, obviously, there are interesting things that you can do in film, nonlinear storytelling, unreliable narrator, same with novels, same with stage plays and things like that. But the interactivity adds a certain extra amount to it. So you have Outer Wilds, which really is like a little mystery that you're putting together yourself, or you have something like Blueprints, which is not ostensibly a narrative game, but there is something in there that is very compelling that if you are willing to look for it and dig a little bit, can peel out this history that lends a lot of that lends a lot of weight to the actions that you're doing. Or something like Disco Elysium, which is a this practically a prose novel. I mean, I would argue that maybe it's a little bit overwritten in places, but nonetheless, the world that they create within it and the things that they say with it are like really compelling, and you get to be just this absolute shambolic mess of a human being stumbling your way through the whole thing. Or you have these things such as Overboard and Expelled, where it's almost like the puzzle into of itself is sort of like how do I get out of this mess, right? And gradually over repeated plays you figure it out while also sort of like meeting and interacting with this interesting cast of characters, and in some cases sort of being like, how can I manipulate them to get the outcome that I want? So and that's the kind of thing, like there are certain types of innovation that happen at the like this very high budget level, but for me, a lot of the more interesting stuff tends to be the smaller games who are made by passionate people who are like, putting everything on the line to like take these risks to tell the kind of story they want to tell.
That's an awesome answer. Okay, I think that has We're noticing a trend with all of these episodes that we do that they could all go on for hours and hours because there's just so much to talk about. But we do have a lot of people to talk to as well. So I guess that's the trade-off we've chosen to make here. So let's wrap it up there. But from both of us, I'm sure, thank you so much for joining us, Josh. That was absolutely brilliant. Like, just wonderful to hear about all your experience and knowledge.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been great. I, you know, I've admired your all's work for years too. So it's just kind of like, I'm glad we finally had a chance to meet and chat.
Absolutely. So. Isn't it nice to meet people in a public way?
Yes. Yes. Rather than a slightly distanced social media garbage fire kind of way. Yeah.
Let's do it on stage. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you both so much.